Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. May 7, 1824, Ludwig von Beethoven's masterwork, his Ninth Symphony, premiered in Vienna. A work like no one had ever heard, an ode to freedom, joy, premiering in the capital of the first modern police state. Beethoven's Ninth Symphony is beloved, revered, honored, played all over the world. Its ode to joy finale lives in billions of minds, whether they want it or not. Its origins tell a story of artistic and philosophical struggle and tough politics that remain unfinished. This hour On Point, Beethoven's Ninth and the origins of his masterpiece. You can join the conversation. Did the Ninth sweep you away when you first heard it? Does it still? What do you hear in this work today? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Joining me now from New York is Harvey Sachs. He's a writer, music historian, and a professor at the Curtis Institute of Music in Philadelphia. His new book is The Ninth, Beethoven and the World in 1824. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Harvey Sachs, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. It's great to be here.
People have known and loved and been amazed and awed and just about everything else by the Ninth for a long time now. What are you setting out to do in your book, Harvey?
Well, I'm trying in my book to set the Ninth in its historic environment and to describe in a foolhardy way, if I may say so myself,
foolhardy,
what actually goes on musically in the Ninth Symphony.
These both sound brave. Let's start with the history. I mean, I've tipped the hat a little bit here, talking about the first modern police state, but that is your point. This premiered in Vienna in 1824. Describe the political environment in Vienna into which this music poured.
Well, as you know, the French Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars had been going on in Europe for about a quarter of a century until 1815. And after that, when Napoleon was defeated, monarchs who had previously reigned in Europe started to make their comeback. And their way of doing it was to reinstitute forms of repressive government in order to sort of shore up their standing. So this was going on from the time of the Congress of Vienna in 1815 right, you know, well into the 1820s. And the leader of the pack, as it were, mm-hmm. was Prince Metternich, who was the foreign minister of the Austrian emperor. And this was going on in Vienna, which is the very city in which Beethoven had been living from the age of 21 in 1792. Lived for the rest of his life until 1827 when he died. So you have this combination going on of Beethoven writing what we might call liberalizing music in the midst of a very, very repressive political atmosphere.
Habsburgs pushing back and Bourbons pushing back and Romanovs pushing back, a big pushback in his music right in the middle of all that. We're going to try this trick of balancing our kind of musical awareness and historical awareness at the same time, sort of pushing sequentially on through Beethoven's Ninth. We're going to hear from James Conlin later in this hour, the great artistic director of the Los Angeles opera, but let's hear a little bit more from Beethoven's Ninth. Here's the second theme from the opening movement of the piece. After starting off with that big, almost bombastic drama, here Beethoven drew back the reins, offers a completely kind of different sound. This is the L.A. Philharmonic with conductor Gustavo Dudamel. This is at the Hollywood Bowl just last October. Pastoral, but then with that kind of ominous bass strings behind, you've given us some of the political here, maybe through the music, begin to reintroduce us to Beethoven, the man here, Harvey Sachs. This is his last symphony. He's no kid.
Beethoven was 53 years old when he completed the Ninth Symphony, and that means that he had already exceeded the average lifespan of a Viennese male of that period. So he was considered fairly old at that point.
And had been deaf at this point for 20 years?
And he was almost, yes, he had been almost completely deaf since about 1818. The Ninth Symphony was completed in 1824. So he was isolated. He lived in a sort of internal exile. And this was both his tragedy and, in a way, what spurred him to invent music that nobody else could even have imagined possible at that time.
And how did it come to be that this musician who had had many aristocratic and royal patrons, I mean, that's just the way it worked in those days, was writing music that was sort of in their face, as you describe it?
Well, you know, I don't think we don't know exactly what Beethoven's political beliefs were. We know that he believed in freedom and brotherhood, and that's part of the what's expressed in the final movement of the Ninth Symphony. But he probably did not believe in a generalized democracy with everybody having equal vote. I think he probably believed in a sort of philosopher king system in which highly intelligent, benevolent people would run whatever country or political system we were talking about. Mm. So, you know, this is what he's aiming at. I don't think he had a direct political aim in writing the Ninth Symphony. But, yes, it was being written and shouted, in a sense, in the face of what was happening around him in the world at that time.
Here's a bit from the middle of the first movement. This is Toscanini and the NBC Orchestra in 1948 in New York. So, Harvey Sachs, what was it on that May evening in 1824 that the audience was hearing that, as you say, had not been heard before?
First of all, they were hearing probably what we would consider an almost impossibly terrible performance of this symphony. Badly rehearsed with a lot of amateur musicians filling in for professionals. And with music that was so new in style that it could hardly have been understood by the musicians, let alone the audience.
Was the deaf Beethoven conducting? Was he engaged?
He was one of three conductors. I mean, the art of the conductor, the profession of the conductor, had not been fully developed by that time. So you had the first violin conducting the strings, the Kapellmeister, the chapel master, literally, directing more or less the whole, and Beethoven setting the tempo from the middle of the orchestra at the beginning of each movement.
I read somewhere, though, that at the end of the whole piece, he was several bars off. He was behind the orchestra in his deafness.
Yes, he was imagining the piece in his head and not able to hear it at all.
And the heart of what had not been heard before, Harvey, how would you describe it?
Pardon me?
The heart of what had not been heard before, the choral piece, yes. Of course, but in the whole.
Well, I would describe what he is doing in the symphony, and this is my own personal interpretation. The first movement is an intense, cataclysmic, almost catastrophic piece that illustrates possibly his own or humanity's despair. And the second movement, the scherzo movement, is a sort of half-hearted combat against human destiny. And the third movement as an acceptance of human destiny and of his own destiny. And the fourth movement as, of course, an incitement to joy, to go a step beyond acceptance and to engage completely with life and with the rest of humanity.
We're going to follow Beethoven's Ninth all the way to that incitement to joy in this hour. Harvey Sachs is with us. His new book is The Ninth, Beethoven and the World in 1824. Here's the sort of raucous end of that first movement. You can join the conversation this hour. What's your question on the history around the inspiration for Beethoven's Ninth? Does the Ninth's Ode to Joy run through your mind, your heart, when? And do you hum it in the last mile of your bike ride, on the treadmill, at the gym? In great moments, in bad moments, we're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK, looking at Beethoven's Ninth. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about Beethoven's Ninth Symphony and the world that inspired it with Harvey Sachs, who's the author of the new The Ninth, Beethoven and the World in 1824. You can join us. Do you still listen to Beethoven on the stereo, on the earbuds? And where do you see yourself when you listen? Conducting, playing on a mountaintop in Vienna? Do we still relate to the declamatory certainty of this piece, Beethoven's Ninth? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Harvey Sachs joins us from New York. And there's that famous, famous, famous bum-bum, 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 Harvey. Where did that come from? How long had Ludwig von Beethoven had that in his pocket before he shared it with the world in Beethoven's Ninth?
I can't tell you that exactly, but we do know that Beethoven was a write and rewrite man, that he sketched his works well before they gelled completely. He didn't first formulate them in his head and then just write down a whole work. So the symphony itself was written mainly in 1823 and early 1824, and that's as much as I can tell you about the actual dating.
Though, by the time we get to the choral piece, where he took Schiller's kind of a joyous drinking song and brings the chorus in, that went back further, didn't it? Hadn't Beethoven
yes.
been... Tell us.
Yeah, he had actually been thinking about writing a setting for that poem, or parts of it, from his early 20s on. And at some point when he was working on the Ninth Symphony, which of course he didn't know at the time would be his last symphony, but at some point while he was working on it, he decided that, yes, this was the moment to fit that poem into the text, the musical text of this work. And, of course, this was the first time in the history of the symphony as a form that voices and singing were put into a symphony.
And when they did, they tell us, as you write implicitly, that the divine spark of joy and the kiss for the whole world which originate above the canopy of stars, all taken from Schiller there, must touch and unite us all, as you write. The spark is there, Beethoven saying, you write, and so is the kiss. We need only feel and accept their presence. We're at 800-423-8255. Let's bring our listeners in, if I may. Harvey Sachs is with us from New York. His new book is The Ninth. Judy, you're on the air, Faceton, Vermont. You're on, Judy.
Yes, hello, Tom.
Hi.
Hello, Harvey. I was headed out, but this stopped me in my tracks. I grew up in the country, way out in the country. I didn't know what classical music was. When I finished college, I studied French and taught it. I went to Paris. And one night, on a balcony on the left bank, I was introduced to Beethoven's Ninth, Mozart, and Bach.
In one night? Oh, boy.
Yes. Well, it began with Beethoven's
Ninth. Yes. Oh,
and
wow.
And then I went to Mozart, and who's my favorite, but Beethoven's Ninth and other Beethovens and Bach. And from then on, I've been totally hooked. Well, I listen to other music also, but that was my introduction to it. And, of course, when I hear it, it takes me back to that beautiful Paris balcony.
A Paris balcony always sounds great, but do you go back to the Ninth? I mean, sometimes it's so grand that I find it almost unbearable.
Well, I find it very easy to take, yes. It tends to raise one up.
No kidding.
It's a... And then, of course, all of the other, they all have their differences. But Beethoven's Ninth is so, I think, to me, it's uplifting.
Oh, well, no kidding. Let's hear a little more. Judy, thanks for your call. Here's the string theme from the second movement, the Scherzo in the Ninth. There in the second movement, remind us, Harvey, just how widely the Ninth has been adopted. I mean, this is kind of the top of the top. Europe basically chosen it as its anthem.
Yes, the Ode to Joy theme from the finale. And that's what most people know or think of when they think about the Ninth Symphony, is the finale with the chorus. But, of course, there are these first three movements. We're listening to part of the second now, and they are purely instrumental movements. And I agree with the caller, Judy, that the cumulative force of the finale at the end of the symphony is uplifting. It's meant to be uplifting. It's
fantastically
meant to pull us out of everything that's gone before in the symphony.
Be embraced, millions, this kiss for the whole world. Brothers, above the starry canopy must a loving father dwell. Do you bow down, millions? Do you sense the creator world? I've got a little tape here of Leonard Bernstein. This is 1958, before taking the stage for a performance of Beethoven's Ninth. And he's talking here in that Bernstein way about the effect of listening to Beethoven's Ninth, his masterwork.
In this Ninth Symphony, for example, where Beethoven has set Schiller's Ode to Joy in the finale, the music goes so far beyond the poem. It gives far greater dimension and vital energy and artistic sparks to these quaint old lines of Schiller. Alle Menschen werden Brüder, all men become brothers. Seid umschlungen Millionen, o ye millions, embrace ye. Ahnest du den Schöpfer Welt, o world, do you sense your creator? In other words, this music succeeds even with those people for whom organized religion fails, because it conveys a spirit of godhead and sublimity in the freest and least doctrinaire way that was typical of Beethoven.
Leonard Bernstein, 1958. He would go on to conduct this at the Berlin Wall after it came down. We'll hear a little bit of that later in the hour. Harvey Sachs is with us. His book is The Ninth David in Toronto. You're on the air, David.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for including me. Mm-hmm. I have some thoughts. I'm a lecturer on music.
Wonderful.
The repression in Vienna at the time reflects the repression from the 18th century of monarchists. But because of the revolution and the literary trends in the 19th century, mm-hmm. which was romantic, which was glorifying the individual and his aspirations and his attempt to go against the monarchy, that Beethoven was able to compose his kinds of works which glorify freedom, and let him struggle against the tension of the monarchists. And my second thought is that the first three movements of the symphony, in Beethoven's great architectural brilliance, with the leap down of motifs in all three movements, the same leap of a fourth down, illustrate this repression downwards on top of humanity. But then the fourth movement begins with a great leap up of a fifth.
Yes.
And that, again, symbolically for Beethoven, who used symbols in his music so beautifully, that is the uplifting motive, and that's how he achieves this freedom and uplifting spiritual dream of his, that man can rise up against fate.
Oh, David, we're very glad for your call. Let's hear a little of that third movement and take it to Harvey Sachs. Here's Toscanini. This is back again in New York. The slow movement in the ninth should be conducted on one's knees, said Toscanini. Very slow and song-like is the instruction from Beethoven. That's beautiful. I want to stop doing my job and just be the audience there, Harvey. It's so great. But what do you make of our caller David's political kind of artistic analysis there?
Well, you know, that's a valid point of view. I think it's a little more complicated than that, and I don't think that Beethoven, as I said before, mm-hmm. I don't think that he had a specific political agenda in mind in writing the symphony. I think that it was intensely personal above all. But, yes, there are always external influences on creative people. And sometimes what they write is subconscious. You know, the external form that a piece can assume is subconscious, is largely subconscious in the mind of the creator.
But you're very good in reminding us how much ferment there was at this time. I mean, this is 1824. This is the year that Lord Byron died in Greece, trying to throw over the Ottoman Empire there. Delacroix, you know, with his masterpiece, and Pushkin pushing against the Tsar, Stendhal, Heine. I mean, the tremendous ferment going on.
Yes, this is the beginning of what we call Romanticism, or at least an early point in the Romantic movement. And the Ninth Symphony is certainly seen as a key work at the beginnings of Romanticism. This is a sort of internalization. Romanticism can be seen as a sort of internalization of revolution. The French Revolution, had failed, at least in the short run. But it was in the hearts of the creative people of the time. They didn't accept, they had to accept outwardly the repressive governments of their respective countries, but they did not accept that repression internally.
Here's a web comment from Brett. He says, aside from the sheer power of the night, the beauty and the waking up and shaking up of the aristocracy and how it begins, he writes, what I find most interesting is that it exemplifies how great artists grapple with themes in their work over time until they bring them to full fruition. It seems Beethoven, this is to Brett, was readying himself, developing his ideas thematically as early as the fifth for the ninth symphony. What do you say, Harvey?
You know, as I said before, Beethoven worked, sketched and rewrote and rewrote until he finally came up with a final product, as it were. I think that, yes, one can see a linear development from his early works through the middle period works, the Eroica Symphony, the Fifth Symphony, and so on and so forth, to the Ninth Symphony and to the other works that he created in the last years of his life. So in that sense, yes, one can see the fifth leading to the sixth and the seventh and the eighth and the ninth symphonies.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. You write, Harvey, Beethoven's brand of romanticism, speaking of romanticism, was born of Enlightenment ideas and ideals, had little connection to some of the murkier or more self-indulgent aspects of the Romantic movement. But you also remind us, not all the romantic icons went for it. You quote Baudelaire, this marvelous piece, quote here, saying he thought of Beethoven as a pioneer of a diabolical aspect of romanticism. And you're quoting him. This is Baudelaire writing. He says, Beethoven began to stir up the worlds of melancholy and of incurable despair that had gathered like clouds in man's internal sky, Maturin in the novel Byron, in poetry Poe, Edgar Allan in poetry, and in the analytical, that is, psychological novel, they projected splendid, dazzling rays onto the latent Lucifer ensconced in every human heart. I mean, Baudelaire wrote, that modern art is essentially demonic in tendency. Whew, Harvey, help us here. What?
Well, I, of course, do not agree with that. I think that the darkness and melancholy that exists in that does exist, of course, in Beethoven also existed before him, certainly in Mozart. And one can even make a case for that in some of Bach's music. But Baudelaire had his own axe to grind. He was trying to find precedents or ancestors to himself and the people he most admired in the works of the so-called early romantics, among whom he placed Beethoven. Mm. So, this is his take on it. Of course, it's completely valid for him. But I don't think many people today who are experts in this field would agree with that at all.
Rita in Hampton, New Hampshire. Rita, you're on the air.
Oh, hello, Tom. This is the most fantastic thing. You do a lot of good things, but I enjoy this so much because I heard my first symphony when I was almost 16, and it was right after the war, and we had no car, we had no transportation whatsoever. We had to get on our bikes, and almost 16, and two boys, and a little bit older, a year and a half.
In Germany.
In Germany, and then we went, my mother had made us some lunch, and that was it. And then we bicycled there, and of course, me being a girl, and this was mountainous, there was a castle on top. The symphony was to be played in Schlossburg, which is, as I said, about 3.5 hours at least to bike. And we were determined to get there. And, of course, I made it too. And,
3.5 hours biking to get the ninth. How wonderful.
Oh, yes.
your endorphins would be running as well as the music.
Well, in any event, I was so tired when I finally reached that castle. the boys ate the lunch and left me a little bit, but I just couldn't eat. I was stretched out there in the grass. And
the music, tell us, our end is coming. Tell us, Rita.
Yes, I'm going to be fast. But it was in the court of the castle. And it was so, and by the way, I'm not a musicologist, but for me, always the third one that you just played is already on the wings of the wings of the brotherhood and whatnot, you know. And I think all these previous movements, they go to the last one and lead you to the last one.
Indeed, they do, Rita. It's as far as we can get before the break here, but I'm glad for you putting us on the mountaintop with the castle. We're talking Beethoven's Ninth. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll go out to the third movement here. We'll be right back with Harvey Sachs. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Beethoven's Ninth Symphony and the world that inspired it. Harvey Sachs is with us. His new book, out today, is called The Ninth, Beethoven and the World in 1824. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Behind us here, the opening of the fourth movement begins with what composer Richard Wagner would call the Schreckensakkord, the terror chord. Of course, the ending of the third before was quiet and peaceful, so this comes on with a real kind of horrifying note before the Ode to Joy comes in. You can join the conversation this hour. What feeling goes up your spine when the Ninth is in its full throes? We're at 800-423-8255. Harvey Sachs joins us from New York, and right now we're delighted to have with us from Los Angeles, James Conlin, Artistic Director of the Los Angeles Opera, also for the Ravinia Festival in Chicago, the Cincinnati May Festival, has conducted Beethoven's Ninth Symphony with orchestras throughout the United States. James Conlin, thank you very, very much for being with us today.
That's my pleasure. Hi, Tom. Hi, Harvey.
It's been performed so many times. What's the challenge of this in particular? When you step up as the conductor to ready your orchestra, your opera, your chorus, what are you thinking when you take on the Ninth, James Conlin?
Well, of all of the Beethoven symphonies, it's probably the most difficult to execute, partially because of the asymmetric character of the last movement in particular. Technically, it's very difficult. The third movement is one of the most delicate movements in all of the symphonic literature, certainly of the period. Delicate in its transparency, in its tranquil but deeply emotional mode. So, in general, it's a very difficult symphony to execute well.
When you hear Tuscan.
Despite the fact that it's executed all the time.
Oh, right. When you hear Toscanini saying the third movement should be, the conductor should conduct on his knees, what do you think?
Well, that's a kind of a meditation, yes. Meditative attitude. It's very, very characteristic of Beethoven, particularly the slow movements of the piano concerto and the violin concerto. You are great examples of that. And many of the sonatas, string quartets. This is a meditative mode. I think that's what he means.
When you come to your opera there in Los Angeles or to a new symphony and you're conducting this, do you enter a dialogue? I mean, actually, not just musical, but do you talk with the musicians about what's going on? Because there is such a transition here over the course of this symphony. By the time you get to the sort of ecstatic joy at the end, do you give them a philosophical framework at the outset for thinking about this, James, or is that out of bounds?
Well, that depends on where you are and how you like. A lot of orchestras don't like to hear that, you know. So conductors have to be extremely, extremely judicious just how much, particularly in the United States. Europe is a different story. And I think, in fact, I lived many years in Germany, 13 years in Germany. They not only appreciate it, they want it. And if you don't do it to some degree, something's missing.
Interesting.
France is the same. I think to some degree Italy is the same. Europeans want to see that your music making is in a greater cultural context. In America, we tend to be a little bit more reserved and puritanical, or even the idea that technically all you have to do, you know, you make sure it's together and you make sure that it's performed.
Mm-hmm.
However, that has to be communicated, and if you don't communicate it verbally, somehow or other it has to get communicated through other means, visually, with your gesture, with whatever the radiance that you're, if you're able to summon that up, whatever mm-hmm. it is, the message has to get across.
You know, as I listened to this again, preparing for the show, it struck me, and I want to put it to you and to Harvey Sachs, but there is such super confident, declamatory authority and power in this piece. And I wonder if, I mean, we look at Europe these days, look at everything these days. Who has the confidence to declaim with such authority? Is that itself something lost to history now, James?
Well, I think a lot of people declaim with authority.
This kind?
Mean that what they're declaiming is of any value.
Well, yes.
Just, you can hear that in our everyday life. You know, turn on any television, radio, you hear a lot of people declaiming on talk shows and things like
well,
that.
Well, yeah.
Political issues and all of that, completely unrelated to any knowledge of or appreciation of the complexity of issues. I think what's important is the difference is that when a genius on the level of Beethoven declaims something, it's certainly worth hearing, and the proof is people have been listening to this for 200 years.
Harvey, how about his times, the man himself, and the cultural confidence expressed here, the spiritual, philosophical confidence? To me, it just hit me hearing it in these shakier days.
I think that Beethoven really believed that he had a mission not only to write great music, but to help mankind, to pull mankind from darkness and obscurity towards the light. And I think one hears that in Fidelio, his only opera.
Mm-hmm.
You hear it in the Missa Solemnis, his great solemn mass, which was written more or less contemporaneous with the Ninth Symphony, and certainly in the Ninth Symphony. He believed that I call what he did the process of universalization of the intimate, taking what was deepest in himself and giving it to humanity. I think that is the essence of the Ninth Symphony and of certainly all of Beethoven's later works, the last five string quartets, his late piano sonatas, and so on and so forth. I feel that, you know, he had this very deeply inside himself.
Let's listen to when the chorus makes its entrance in the ninth, in the fourth movement. And, of course, after that stormy instrumental introduction to the finale, Beethoven introduces the solo male baritone voice singing in German, "Oh, friends, not these tones. Rather, let us raise our voices in more pleasing and more joyful sounds. Joy, joy." Voice enters the symphony, and soon enough we'll be off with a great chorus. Let's get a call from Sarasota, Florida, and Penny. Penny, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question from the perspective of a chorister, and I haven't really heard anybody address how I've heard people talk about how technically difficult it is,
mm-hmm.
but I wondered if your guest had any input on how... was it really performed in this key back when he presented it? Because I don't know how the voices could have reached back then. I think we're in better physical shape these days. But I'm talking from the perspective of a chorister. So I want
you mean some of the high notes here, the sopranos in particular, expected to hit.
Mm-hmm.
Right. James Conlon, how about it?
Well, I think I can address that. And that there's, you're partially correct in the sense that, yes, the general pitch was all lower 200 years ago, and so that would have rendered it slightly easier than it is today. Also, in general, and this applies to the men, most high tenors sang the upper register, the high notes, in what's called a head voice or a falsetto. It was not yet common to be singing with your full voice. So that is another. That also means that they were not as voluminous as we are, you know, would expect today. All that being said, there's no way that this was any easier. 200 years ago, it was probably even more difficult. Beethoven's famously unsympathetic to the natural tendencies of voices, and he said so. Frankly, he wrote what he wanted to write, and this has rendered the Missa Solemnis, Fidelio, all of these extremely difficult to sing. But that's just the way it is. You have to do it, and it has, it has produced animals in the last 200 years that have learned to do that, and we are that. But nevertheless, it is still very difficult.
Penny, that sounds like a steep hill then and now. Thank you for that call. Here's a Facebook comment, Harvey Sachs, from Dana. Writes, it always fascinates me the man capable of writing such a momentous piece dedicated to human kindness and goodwill was by many accounts rude, crass, unapproachable, a man who could throw a plate of food at a waitress for bringing coffee too early. Despite this, 20,000 people showed up at his funeral in Vienna. What do you say to that, Harvey?
Well, Beethoven, as a result of his deafness, became increasingly sort of exiled from daily life.
Mm-hmm.
And extremely suspicious of other people, the people around him, the servants, and so on, and his friends. Even he could be very, very rough on them. But he was also loved. I mean, he was considered an eccentric, a genius, somebody who had great heart and could be extremely generous to others, but who was very difficult and unpredictable in his daily behavior.
Let's go to South Burlington, Vermont, and Will. Will, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I just would like to start by observing that I don't think Beethoven was completely apolitical or asocial. After all, he did dedicate his Third Symphony to Napoleon and then later famously retracted that dedication.
Mm.
There's a story about him slashing the document with a knife.
Right.
But to me, what I hear in the Ninth Symphony and Beethoven's accomplishment is the struggle. I hear the struggle to maintain that upsurge of joy, that experience of transcendence, and yet maintain coherence, to channel it in a coherent way. The Indian saint Sri Ramakrishna, in describing his experience of samadhi, which was merging of the universal consciousness with the individual, said, "What happens to a salt doll when it dives into the ocean?" So I can hear that constant surging that would transcend his consciousness, and yet he constantly brings it back into coherence when it finally bursts forth in that great chorus in the fourth movement that we all have experienced.
Oh, Will, that's a wonderful bit of interpretation. And I hate to do this, but I just want to drop in this one little piece. I hate to put this right behind Sri Ramakrishna, but as all that struggle has been put to many uses, as Harvey Sachs reminds us, the Ninth has been used as a battle flag by liberals and conservatives, Democrats, autocrats, Nazis, communists, anarchists. Here's a little bit played in 1942 for the eve of Adolf Hitler's birthday party, a bit of the finale with Hitler, Goebbels in attendance, both sides of the stage, enormous flags, swastikas draped. Harvey Sachs, what did the Nazis say of, how did they see the Ninth?
Well, I think that the Nazis, like other political organizations, attempted to use it for their own ends. I mean, for them, Beethoven was simply an exemplar of the great Teutonic Germanic culture that they felt they were bringing to its maximum, and that was going to rule the world eventually. I don't think Beethoven himself would have been very happy with the use of that for those purposes at all, although he certainly did believe in the primacy of German music at that time, in his own time.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's have a big palate cleanser here. This is the full ode with Leonard Bernstein's monumental Berlin performance on Christmas Day 1989, celebrating the fall of the Berlin Wall, changed Freude or joy in Schiller's text to Freiheit or freedom in honor of the occasion. In the program notes, he said, "I'm sure Beethoven would have given us his blessing." Now that was the scene celebrating the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989. James Conlon, what are you hoping audiences walk out of a performance of Ninth under your direction, having glimpsed or feeling?
Well, pretty much anything. The goal of any performance is to transcend the listener from his or her time and place, our time and places, and put us all in a sphere where we are able to experience intense emotions, insight, spiritual change, all of that. And, of course, the Ninth Symphony of Beethoven is considered, rightly, one of the great testaments and documents to that power. Mm-hmm. It should be seen not just because of its text. I think it's also important not to lose sight of the fact that the first three movements of the symphony constitute part of its perfection. You know, the last movement is popular, become popular, and the Ode to Joy is rightfully become a hymn and an anthem universally. But the fact is, it is also a symphony with four extraordinary movements, the culmination, it turns out, of his symphonic art.
A kiss for the whole...
In its entirety. Not...
Indeed, a kiss for the whole world, as Schiller wrote from above the canopy of stars. James Conlon, Artistic Director for the Los Angeles Opera, thank you so much for being with us this hour. And Harvey Sachs with the new book, The Ninth Beethoven in the World in 1824. Harvey, thank you very much for the book and for your time today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
We'll go out with Seiji Ozawa's conducting the finale, 1998, the Olympics in Nagano, Japan. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.